Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Traveling internationally for business or pleasure has become a cornerstone of our modern global economy. But no matter how commonplace it becomes, there are still rules and procedures to follow when going between one sovereign state and another. When traveling between the USA and Canada, the US State Department recommends that travelers check their COVID-19 policies, make sure that they take note of different emergency services numbers, and pack their passports. When traveling from the USA to Somalia, the State Department recommends that travelers leave expensive belongings behind, draft a will, establish a proof of life protocol, appoint someone to look after their estate, and assign someone to be the point of contact with hostage takers. The country is so inundated with crime, civil unrest, and organised military groups that even the USA withdrew its embassy from the capital of Mogadishu in 1991 and set up operations in Kenya instead because it was safer. They have since reopened a small diplomatic fortress, but most of the work is still done across the border. Economics is about providing optimal outcomes with the resources provided. Somalia is an interesting, albeit tragic, case study of how such suboptimal outcomes are maintained, and what an economy looks like when even the largest and most powerful military in the world struggles to set up permanent operations there. For more than a decade, Somalia was effectively a stateless region of anarchy with no universally recognised governments or institutions. A lot of countries we've explored on this channel have been in pretty rough situations, but even then they could at least point to the group that was in charge. That's important because even things as basic as international aid require someone to talk to. What is truly remarkable is that a lot of economists agree that the period of Somali anarchy was actually better for the economy than the period of state control that came before it. When what is effectively the purge is better at coordinating the economy than the government, a lot of things have clearly gone wrong. In the years since, things have not gotten much better. Today, the economy is one of the poorest in the world, with the average person producing just over a dollar a day in economic output. The country technically has a recognised government now, but its borders are riddled with disputed regions and areas under the control of self-declared states and military organisations. So, what industries exist in an economy this fragmented? Is there any realistic way that Somalia could turn this situation around? And finally, what can we learn from a country that has had to rely on such an extreme economic system? Once we've done all of that, we can, as always, put Somalia on the Economics Explained National Leaderboard. One of the preeminent economists of our time, Thomas Sowell, said that economics is not about what is better, it's about trade-offs. Before technology increased productivity, we used to spend a lot of time doing domestic work like cooking. But because we no longer have time to spend hours preparing food, we get something fast that is generally less healthy. That's why I'm so excited about this video sponsor, Factor, because it's solving that exact problem. Factor's meals are not only cheaper than takeout or fast food, which is already a plus, but they're approved by dietitians who've been nutritionally balanced and healthy. I love this because there's nothing worse than feeling like you always have to choose between your health and having time for your work. But Factor's meals are ready to be heated up in a few minutes, so I don't have to make that trade-off anymore. And if you need an afternoon snack to tide you over till dinner, Factor has a bunch of options for healthy bites and smoothies for your mid-afternoon hunger pangs as well. Head to factormeals.com/EEP50 and use code EEP50 to get 50% off. That's code EEP50 at factormeals.com/EEP50 to get 50% off.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Somalia today effectively operates as two distinct states, with Somalia and its current government controlling the south of the country, and the separatist Somaliland claiming de facto independence in the north. Their nationhood is not currently recognised by any other country in the world, or any organisations like the UN, the IMF, or the World Bank. Somaliland does, however, have representative offices all over the world, including in Australia, Canada, and the United States. These aren't officially embassies, but they do act like ones. Somalia, on the other hand, has what is known as de jure sovereignty over the northern region. De jure sovereignty means that everybody recognises that they control that area, even though the reality is that they don't. This kind of shady grey sovereignty is actually not that unusual in the world. The country of Cyprus in the Mediterranean is divided into two. Most other countries only recognise the Republic of Cyprus and their control over the entire island, but the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus has effective control over the north of the island and acts totally independently of the south. Then of course there is Taiwan, that again, most countries do not officially recognise as an independent state, but it still has its own democracy, elected government, it raises its own taxes, has its own laws, its own military, passports, flag, and most importantly, its own people that see themselves as Taiwanese, not mainland Chinese. Now, just because these systems are not uncommon doesn't mean that they are not without their difficulties, especially for struggling countries like Somalia. If it has any chance of growing its economy and improving the lives of its citizens, it's going to need to invest into infrastructure and industries that can leverage its place in the global economy. The problem is, at the moment, it's impossible to know exactly how to make those investments, or even where to start. If a foreign investor builds a port or a factory to leverage the low-cost labour pool of Somalia, will their ownership still be recognised by any of the other groups in the country if they take over that location? Beyond even investments, it's difficult to supply humanitarian services because it comes down to knowing what organisations to work with in different parts of the country and being very careful that they don't just take the supplies for themselves. The last time the country was fully unified was, sort of, in 1991, before the collapse of the increasingly authoritarian government that was backed by the Soviet Union because of the country's strategic position at the mouth of the Suez Canal. We say sort of because, well, even back then there were groups trying to separate from or overthrow the government. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, the government lost its economic support and the country quickly collapsed into a civil war. This caused a humanitarian crisis as the people who were mostly dependent on subsistence agriculture were forced out of their lands, causing a famine that threatened the lives of millions. The UN got involved in humanitarian operations, but quickly required military assistance as they were targeted for their food by the warring factions. This eventually resulted in US-led operations across the country, like the unsuccessful Battle of Mogadishu, which is probably best known as the Black Hawk Down incident. The conflict spread across the country and destroyed a lot of what little infrastructure the economy did have in place, which meant that the small non-agrarian industries that did exist in Somalia before the war were just not viable after it. For perspective on just how bad the situation was on the ground for average people living in the country during this time, a lot of prominent economists have actually speculated that the economy ran better in the totally stateless anarchical aftermath of the Civil War than it did during the authoritarian rule before 1991. Key development indicators like GDP per capita, life expectancy, infant mortality, maternal mortality, and access to healthcare all improved when the country had no government and individual towns would basically just run themselves. The economists conducting these studies theorised that the corrupt state was such a drain on the economy's limited resources that the order and stability, if you can call it that, which the government provided was not worth the mismanagement and theft it was overseeing. One clear example of this is the nation's currency, the Somali shilling, which despite all of the problems in the country has been in circulation since 1921, more than 100 years. Other far wealthier and more stable economies from around the world have had to replace their currencies multiple times in the past century because they've done irreparable damage with things like hyperinflation or currency depegging. Since for such a long time, Somalia has not had a reliable government, central bank or mint, it's had a pretty stable money supply. It's not printed new cash since 1991, when the previous government fell, and given that it's such an informal economy, almost all transactions are done in cash. Because of this, while other developing economies around the world have struggled with runaway inflation, Somalia has actually had stable deflation and very consistent foreign exchange rates. Now, this is not to say that Somalian-style anarchy is something that we should try in our own economies. Somalia is home to very basic industries that don't require a lot of oversight, infrastructure, or assistance from government services. Something like selling crops at a local market is not going to benefit too much from government oversight, and corrupt government officials looking to take their cut from bribes or extortion money can make the whole thing worse. But something like developing cutting-edge technologies for computers is going to benefit from government assistance. The companies running these industries will need infrastructure like roads and ports to get their products to markets domestically and around the world, and they need protections, both legally to ensure that people don't steal their technologies, and physically to make sure that their facilities are not ransacked by armed groups. Of course, the complete lack of oversight has also made some other industries possible, especially the one that most people think of when they think of Somalia. piracy. Some countries contribute more to the global economy than others, but for a long time, Somalia was one of the unique cases where its existence was a net cost to the global economy, even by gross output figures. At the height of piracy off the coast of Somalia, the attacks were estimated to be costing the global economy between $12 and $18 billion a year in additional insurance, naval operations, and alternative shipping routes further away from the coast. Somalia itself at this time only had a GDP of around $4 billion. The piracy itself is a fascinating case study into market economics, but before diving into that, the discrepancy is often used as a perfect example of demonstrating the value of foreign aid. Sometimes giving billions of dollars to countries to help with humanitarian efforts or to develop infrastructure might not sound like the best use of taxpayer money, which should logically be used on projects where the tax is collected. However, there are lots of arguments for foreign aid, just building a better world and alleviating human misery being a big one. But even if we look at it through the lens of a heartless economist that only wants to know what's in it for them, foreign aid can be a really good investment because it can get rid of indirect costs like this. That $18 billion in additional global shipping costs is going to be passed along to consumers anyway, and small investments to build out local industries or to support local government law enforcement has the potential to completely wipe out costs like this. At its height, piracy in Somalia was one of the most raw examples of free market dynamics without basically any interference from a government. The pirate raids off Somalia may look simple, but they were quite expensive operations because the groups performing these attacks required weaponry, radars, and boats capable of keeping up with massive container ships. In a country with a GDP per capita of only $400 a year at the time, those were major assets. To make this lucrative industry possible, the country organically developed a stock market of sorts for pirate raids, where people could invest as a group into boats and equipment and share in the profits from a successful ransom. Beyond just the craziness of a market for piracy, this is especially interesting for economists because investment markets are normally considered to require a very high level of regulation. If someone made an investment into a pirate raid, it could potentially be difficult for them to collect their share of the profits if the group of armed pirates decided that they wanted to keep it all for themselves. But here in a country with no functioning government, people came together to make sure that this market operated efficiently and securely enough to keep a multi-billion dollar industry operating for over a decade. It's almost heartwarming until it's remembered that most of this money was made by taking innocent people hostage. Today, Somalian piracy is in decline because of a combination of a strong naval presence off the coast and a more established government back on land. In 2012, the Constitution of Somalia was signed and a new federal government was established. It still has problems and disputed territories, but for the first time in two decades, the country had leadership that was identifiable. Today, the capital city of Mogadishu is even going through something of a development boom. Since the establishment of the new government, the economy of Somalia has been growing, and it's also becoming less dependent on activities like piracy. Now, it's not growing from a very high starting point, and most people in the country still live in absolute poverty. But the situation is improving. And nowhere is that more clear than in the capital city of Mogadishu. For the last three decades, this city was littered with bombed-out buildings left over from conflicts, but now fancy new apartment buildings and shopping centres have been constructed to accommodate ex-Somali residents that fled the country that are now returning and bringing their purchasing power back from overseas. This has created a surprisingly advanced problem for the still very underdeveloped economy. It has an unaffordable housing market. By using the best available data, Mogadishu is more expensive to live in than Austin, Texas. The big disclaimer here is that getting reliable data from a city like Mogadishu is very difficult. Most of their economy is entirely informal, and economists can't go and conduct primary research because they will probably be held for ransom. Part of this housing problem is simply supply. The country only started properly building new modern homes 5 to 10 years ago, and in that time, construction materials have become very expensive, so supply is very limited. Another major cost are general goods and services. Without well-developed infrastructure like roads and ports, it's hard to stock shelves with food and other goods because it's expensive to import and transit. Electricity is also a big problem. Since the country hasn't had time to build out new power plants and transmission lines, electricity is unreliable and very expensive. Then there is security. Anybody wealthy enough to afford the new homes being built in the city will become a target for violent groups that still definitely exist. The city becoming unaffordable raises the risk of pushing people out before proper industries have the chance to gain a foothold in the country. It's building those industries which is Somalia's best chance of never regressing back to the lawless anarchy it was just a decade ago. Okay, Now it's time to put Somalia on the Economics Explained, a national leaderboard. Starting as always with size, Somalia has a GDP of $7.6 billion, making it the 157th largest economy in the world. Despite its relatively large size and population, it has a lower GDP than Monaco, which is obviously on the extreme opposite end of the wealth spectrum, but is only 3 kilometres across and home to 37,000 people. Somalia gets a 2 out of 10. GDP per capita is amongst the world's worst. Any type of formal economic activity has struggled to develop in Somalia, and even with the country's recent improvements, most of its people still live in terrible poverty and rely on community self-sufficiency rather than the broader economy. With a GDP per capita of only $447, Somalia gets a 0 out of 10. The country also obviously gets a 0 out of 10 for stability and confidence. Its borders are divided up between warring factions, most people are not formally integrated into the economy, its cities are too dangerous for even diplomatic missions to operate effectively, and it's best known for piracy. Growth is a hard one to measure properly, because the World Bank and the IMF were unable to properly collect data in the country between 1990 and 2013, and it's World Bank and IMF GDP figures that we normally use for this growth ranking. The good news is that since they have been able to start collecting data, growth has been very strong, roughly doubling the country's economy in the past decade. Of course, it was starting from an extremely low benchmark to begin with, and most of this growth has just been from people simply engaging with the formal economy, but that's still a step in the right direction, so it gets a 9 out of 10. Industry is basically non-existent. Most of the country still relies on growing food for themselves, and outside of some pockets of development in Mogadishu, the country's biggest export industry has historically been ransoms, which are not highly valued in today's modern global economy. Somalia gets a 1 out of 10. Altogether, that gives Somalia an average score of 2.4 out of 10, which means it just avoids the bottom spot on the leaderboard. The country that did get the bottom spot was Lebanon, and we've already made an entire video on that, which you should be able to click to on your screen now. Thanks for watching, mate. Bye.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.